Welcome to episode 29 of the British Ultronin podcast. It's Friday the 10th of January 2020. We're back. Happy New Year. Just a quick preface before we get going. An issue with the conversation between myself and Dan, and then the main interview with ultrarunning historian and statistician Annie Milroy. Initially, the sound is not the best between Dan and I. We've got a few reverb issues. We are still trying to work out how to podcast properly. And our main aim over the next few months is to be a bit more frequent with our episodes, but also just try and get some kind of production level in place. It's still, as many of you are aware, basically a phone call between Dan and I. And whilst that does appear to be popular, there is a lot more we could be doing. So we will try. As for the main interview, this is part one of a two-part interview with Annie Milroy, because there is simply so much to go through with the man who's as knowledgeable as Andy that we just can't compress it into less than an hour, which we kind of set as our maximum time limit for any one episode. Andy is the gatekeeper in many ways to the history of our sport. We need to make sure that we consult Andy as much as possible today to improve running and the sport in general. So initially, a conversation with myself and Dan before moving on about 25 minutes into the interview with Andy. Enjoy this first part, and we'll be back with part two in the next couple of weeks. Welcome to episode 29 of the British Ultrarunning Podcast. It's 2020. And Dan Lawson is in the house. Welcome, Dan.
Hi, James. How you doing? Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
New Year. 29th of 2020. How are you?
Yeah, like 7 out of 10 today. It's an improvement on recent weeks. How about you?
Yeah, I'm really well. I'll give myself 8.5.
Wow, good number. Yeah, excellent. Yeah.
And we haven't spoken for a while, have we? I haven't spoken to you since before Christmas.
What's before we get into it, what's our New Year's resolution about how often we're going to do this?
You put me on the spot there. How long have we been, how many episodes do we produce a year anyway?
One a month, average.
One a month, that's all right, isn't it?
Well, I thought so, but it's been at least 2.5 months again since the last one. By the way, I tried listening to Sergei Dus's Ukrainian ultrarunning podcast, and it is indeed all in Ukrainian. So I didn't get far into it. But
how long did you... A couple of minutes.
It's a great language to listen to. Very soothing, but I have no idea what they're talking about, so...
Do you have your Ukrainian English dictionary at hand?
If you do speak fluent Ukrainian, then head over.
You can do it on Google Translate. You can just have record 2 minutes of it and then stop it, listen back on Google Translate. Maybe I'll try it.
Well, that's an idea. So how's your running been, Dan? How many miles a week are you running right now? How many?
I don't know, like 100K maybe a week or something. Yeah. And I feel great. It's amazing, yeah.
Good.
Actually, yeah, I do feel I can get up in the morning and walk down the stairs, like, properly.
Always nice, yeah.
I feel like I've got energy and I've got... And it's just, yeah, I'm really, really loving it. And I feel like my body's kind of... refreshing as well, so I think it's something that I've needed to do for a long time.
You've not booked many races, right? So the reason you're taking a little bit of relaxy time is that you've got an eye on Joggle in May, or Le Jog, or I forget which way round, but is there anything before that on the horizon? Any events you might dive into?
I'm going to Navan in February. I'm going to run as a warm up for the Joggle. I'm going to run their last man standing, the backyard ultra type event. Mm-hmm. I think it's the 15th of February. You know how the format works. Don't you? It's just the last one. It's 4.1 miles every hour until the last person's out there. But I think as opposed to the one in America. This one has a cut-off, so they stop it at 48 hours, regardless of how many people are still going.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and this is this could win you a golden ticket into Laz's original Biggs Backyard Ultra. Is that right?
Yeah, I think the winner. Yeah, you get is it a golden ticket or a golden coin into the Biggs Backyard in October? I think it is.
Yeah. Sweet. You could do well there. You know. In fact, congratulations are in order because today's guest recently emailed us to say that, Dan, you officially hold the world best performance of 2019 for the six-day format. So congrats on your title. It's a great result.
Thank you very much.
It's a great result. Yeah. So world-leading six-day runner for 2019, Dan Lawson. Good. That's good. Exciting. It's a new format for you.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. It's interesting. Robbie's going to get me doing some like race-specific training where I'm going to just practice like running and then stopping for like 5 or 10 minutes and not doing anything and then running again, which should be good. But actually, the thing I'm worried about the most is because it's cold, isn't it? And it's February, and we were in Navan Island for the World Championships in like July, and it was really cold then. It's that bit when you stop. You're right if you keep running, but it's that bit where each lap that we will, with most runners, I think we'll be stopped for like 5-10 minutes, and it's trying to keep warm in that bit before you set off again.
It's definitely a tactical race in terms of how you approach it, how fast you run and how much recovery time you give yourself between loops, whether you just keep going at 4.1 miles an hour or you give yourself 5, 10, 15 minutes, 20 minutes between each lap, and what you do in terms of eating, drinking, trying to get a nap. They're all considerations. What's the course? Is it just a road loop or is it trail or what?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. I don't know. I've seen a video of it and it looks like it's a little bit of both, but with a few little gradients and stuff. So,
Right. Yeah,
it should be cool. I'm looking forward to it, man. And by the time I race that, you'll have completed two races? You're at the arc.
What? Yeah, I've got an entry to the Arc of Attrition, but that's it. I don't have any others.
Oh, you're not running capital to...
I know, we've retired. I told you, I've retired from that event. That was... Well, the day you ran it last year was like we finally got you on the start line and that was it for me. It's like, right, he's run it, so now we can all stop. No, Drew's running again. He's running his 12th consecutive. He's run every edition. Luckily for me, I've missed a couple of years, so I've got no pressure on me to keep that streak alive, and I can focus on the Arc of Nutrition, which I'm very excited to go and run, even though I've done practically no training since Phoenix because I had a chest infection over Christmas.
But what distance are you doing? Are you doing 100?
I'm in for the 100. Yeah, I did the 50 with you last year, didn't I? I am down for the 100 and I'm planning on giving it a bash, as they say.
Giving it a proper bash, going for the win.
Well, I think that's ridiculous, considering. I think there's lots of strong local runners. I think it attracts some good runners from across the UK too. I think it's got a bigger field this year. I'm just looking for a solid race. You know, if I can be as solid as I was at the Ridgeway, you know, being sick at about mile 20 and then, you know, walking for 20 miles and then running a bit and then walking to the finish, I think it's a good day. So
it's a good day out on the path. Yeah, but you know that path well. You're almost a local yourself.
Oh, yeah. No, I've not set foot on the first 50 miles. Yeah. I've not set foot on the first 50 miles. I did look at the maps yesterday, actually, to remind myself of where we were overtaken, shall we say, during the 50 last year by following the correct route. And, you know, just taking a bit of advice from Drew on some of the earlier sections. I do hope to get down there for a day or two before the actual race, but I can't see it happening.
Are you gonna stick to the correct route, or are you gonna look for those little cuts or not?
I'm going to stick as far as I can possibly see it to the southwest coast path. The way I understand it is there's lots of places where the southwest coast path. Well, as we know, there's three paths very close to one another that end up in the same place, and there's a bit of ambiguity over which one is the southwest coast path. What I shall not be doing is looking for road shortcuts, cutting off bits of headland that require a little more time. And I did, as we spoke about last year, I did feel that that was happening during.
Try not to get angry this year.
Yeah, I'll try.
Be more zen. Yeah. Right. So, tell me about Desert Solstice, man. Because you had a good build up. Yeah.
Had a super build up. Felt really good.
You were racing. You were winning consistently. Your six-hour races.
Just clearing up.
Used car parks. Every other day.
Yeah, just earning a living, really, from running. You know, as professional runners, you know, there's a lot of prize money at stake. I went in shape. I felt really good. We had Michael Seymour, who is the GB 24-hour crew captain, out crewing us. It's great to have him out for the trip. Robbie had a knee injury, and honestly, from before we even went out there, I think he felt that it was a bit of a stretch to think that it was going to hold out for the distance. And unfortunately for him, just a few hours in, he was in quite a lot of pain. And he got to about 50K and he was just like, this isn't happening. So he pulled off the course. So I ended up with a very high quality crew of two. And for the first 10 hours or so, it was going really, really steady, really well. All the food and drink was going in, bang on plan. Yeah, so I was running around 10 and a half hours in. Mick's getting excited by this point. He's like, mate, this is going so well. And I was like, yes, it's really going well, mate. Felt really good. It had been hot again. I was, you know, that crusty, salty sweat. So I was a bit worried I was dehydrated, but I did feel good. And I was literally running the bend and just started being sick. And it's not like a little sick. It's like this stomach emptying projectile vomit. Robbie ran over. He's like, what's going on? I was like, I don't know. But I looked at my watch. It was probably within 20 minutes of what happened the last two times. Anyway, so I carried on running. About an hour later, it happened again. And then I just was not able to settle my stomach. So I was running hot and just being sick, feeling really nauseous. Yeah, it was awful. It was really awful. And Mick's like, fuck, what are we going to do? And I was like, I really don't know. Tried lots of different things, you know, salty soup, tried moving off the sports nutrition, a bit of real food. A bit more dry retching. And at this point, the goal is slipping away, and I'm just like, how does this keep happening? You know, this is a completely different nutritional approach this time. So, you know, proper electrolyte plan, everything else, and just could not get it back. Robbie was obviously like, just carry on, just keep going. You know, it will turn itself around, even if it's 2-3 hours time. And then, of course, the more you walk, the sort of stiffer you get, and you start thinking, this is a pointless exercise again. But I did feel this year, because I felt mentally good and still motivated, I was like, well, look, I'll just keep going around this time. And I ended up alongside Pete Kostelnik, who is a really lovely guy. And we just basically were walking together, consoling one another for a couple of hours. He was off the track himself for 3 hours, and we both sort of said, well, we're just going to get ourselves to 100 miles and call it what it is. Desert Solstice do 100, but it's 100 mile and a 24-hour running alongside one another. So we just went for that and got to about 18 hours, and just that was it. Robbie sort of felt that I should carry on walking to 24, and I did kind of agree it was probably better to do it. But then I just thought, you know, this is not going anywhere fast. Am I going to walk off here with 200k having walked for 10 hours? Am I going to walk off with 100 miles in 18? So very sadly, that was it for another capitulation.
So what's the diagnosis?
This is the problem. Last couple of times, we sort of said, oh, it's the electrolyte imbalance, oh, it's dehydration, the food, the carb balance, maybe the heat. And I come out this time thinking, I'm just not quite sure what it is. Because for 10 hours, it was all going really, really well. And mentally and physically, I was better prepared this time. You know, I felt in a much better place because I've been less busy in the run-up. So I really don't know. I really don't know. But it's a concern because even in the point-to-point races, it's kind of happened this year. I definitely felt rough in the last few hours of the West Highland Way race. Obviously, I felt rough from very early on in the Ridgeway. And traditionally, I've not really had too many stomach issues. So it is a problem that I need to keep working at. What the answer is, I really don't know.
So what does that mean for you now, 24-hour races?
Well, I think it's a good place to stop trying. I've just had like four in a row that have just gone pear-shaped. I'm definitely not done with the format, but I definitely feel like I need a good break from it. I need to go and work on the issue of getting my stomach sorted at some events which are, let's say, slightly more appealing from a running and psychological standpoint. I've still got the desire, but I don't want to just keep flogging a dead horse. If I'm going to keep running into the same issue, I need to work that issue out before I keep trying again. The problem, as we know, is how do you simulate in training being 12 hours into a 24-hour race without running for 12 hours, which is not good for training.
It's tough, isn't it? I mean, I'm just wondering how you feel, whether you feel like, I can't be arsed anymore, or you're like, I really want to beat it.
I feel like, because of 24-hour format, you can run a number. I feel like the number, like my PB number, is a decent number. If you said to me, oh, you retire here, you never run again, I'd still look back on my 242K and I'd be like, well, that's, you know, it's not stellar, but for me, it's a good number. The problem is, I know I can do more. And until I've had that kind of better race, I don't feel like I'm finished with it.
But you see, I'm saying I'd quite like to never run a 24-hour race ever again. But I feel like...
You've got one more big one at least.
Well, I can't stop until at least I just run a reasonably decent one again. You know, like, I don't know. 2.5, late 2.50s or something, and then I could say, all right, I'm done.
I've glimpsed, you've had a really good one, and I've glimpsed, like when we were in Timisoara last year, 2 years ago, I really, you know, went through 100 miles in about 15 hours, and at that point I was glimpsing, you know, I was having the greatest race. And then something went horribly wrong there, which I think is actually different to what's happened this last couple of times at Desert Solstice, but it just completely imploded. But I know it's stupid to say with eight hours left, I was close to getting it really right, but I felt like I was. I've sort of now glimpsed it. I do want to one day have that race, but it's just not working. I've got to sort my stomach out before I keep trying.
Okay. So, do you think in 2020 you'll do another 24 hours?
No, I think I'll leave it at least a year. I've got eyes on other things this year.
What are your eyes on?
Well, I think I'm going to run the Arc, and then I think Drew and I are going to do a Paddy Buckley together in Wales.
Paddy Buckley is the one in Wales.
Yeah. And then I've got a place at UTMB, which is slightly out of my field. I actually have a place at Lakeland too, but I think I'm going to ditch that and run UTMB again. It's been many years, and when we did it, Robbie and I was 2012, and they amended the course, so I feel like it's kind of unfinished business. And as much as I hate the crowds, it's still an incredible route, and I feel motivated to try it again. So that's that, really.
If you run fast enough, there's not that many crowds.
Yeah, quite. So,
Wow, that's so. What's your dream goal for UTMB? What do you want to run? What time? When you ran it before, what was your time?
Oh, well, we ran like a 110K shortened weather route.
It was the Jez Bragg one, yeah? Was it that
yes. Year? Oh, no, no, that was a different year when I also ran it. But the last time I ran it was, I can't remember who won, I think Francois Dane maybe, but it was 100 and something, yeah, just over 100K up and around the valley and stuff. It was proper shit. I'd like to go out there and recce it properly again, because before I did it the first time, I did go round the whole route, but I haven't seen a lot of the route for probably 10 years or more.
I'll be up for a recce with you. I love it. That
route. Oh, it's beautiful, isn't it?
Charlotte's family lived, don't they? They live in...
Les Uches.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether I'm super excited or just a bit confused at the moment, but... yeah, it's a disappointing end to the year. I do feel like my running has dropped a couple of levels in the last couple of years, and that's mainly just inconsistency in training and time. So more than anything, I'd just like to get some consistent training in and feel, you know, closer to, you know, where I was a couple of years ago. You know what that's like. You have these ebbs and flows, don't you? So, yeah.
Yeah. And I... one really exciting thing is I was listening to Ian Corliss's podcast the other day.
Right.
And he was interviewing Zach Bitter, and Zach Bitter said he's coming to your track race. Is that,
indeed.
Is that true?
Indeed. Yeah, I'm just trying to finalise details with Zach and Camille. Both.
Whoa,
are,
man. That's amazing. Both, huh?
Yeah, I mean, it could be. I don't want to get too excited until... you know, we sign them up, but I'm speaking to Camille again tomorrow, and Zach, it seems like he's in. I've sent him the registration link. I'm just waiting for him to sort his travel plans out.
Did you hear the podcast as well?
I did not. No, I'm interested to hear that he said on there that he's running it.
Well, it's interesting that he said he was running the track race that Robbie Britton organises in England.
Yeah. Well, Robbie was, to be fair, Robbie was the one who tapped him up out in Desert Solstice, because he ran a US 100K track record during that event. Robbie was obviously chatting to him because he was off the track, so he was busy tapping him up for the track race. So kudos to Robbie for selling it in.
Alexander
is in. We've booked him up. He's all signed up and travel and sorted and everything. So we've got the World 24-Hour Men's Champion, the World 24-Hour Women's Champion, the men's and women's 100-mile world record holders, all in the same race.
Oh, my God. And a plethora of English talent as well.
Yeah, the best of British.
British talent.
Yeah, and two Norwegian international runners... It's good to see some international names, though, right?
Yeah, it's amazing. So yeah. I'm supposed to... It's the Brighton Marathon that weekend. I'm supposed to be working, but I'm going to do all I can to have the Saturday off to come up to it, yeah, and hopefully help out in some way. Yeah,
what I'd like to do is get some kind of coverage going for people that can't make it.
I'm up for it, yeah.
I would urge anybody who's around Ashford on the 18th of April or can get to Ashford on the 18th of April to come and see, come down and watch, because there's not going to be many opportunities to see a race of this calibre without going to a World Champs 24.
Oh, man, yeah. Not even if you're near Ashford, if you're anywhere.
In the same continent.
Yeah. Get yourself there. Yeah, it's gonna be awesome.
I'm just crossing my fingers that they all eventually confirm, because I don't want to sort of get too excited until they're actually on the list. But also that those three in particular make the start line fit and healthy, because as you and I both know, when you're pushing the line in training to get there, you can break. I mean, Camille just tried to take on the 48-hour world record, and she stopped at 100K with a hamstring problem. So things do go wrong, but God, if we see three fit, healthy athletes of that level on the start line, it could be incredible. I mean, obviously the dream would be for one of them to go and set a new world best mark. It's creating quite a headache logistically. We've got to get anti-doping on site, and To be fair, we had everything else sorted out for last year, but the anti-doping are on standby, whereas this time we actually have to have them at the track, I think, because...
Oh, you have to. So you're thinking, so do you think Zach Bitter will try to beat his record?
100%. Yeah. 100%. Yeah, he's gone out and said that he feels there's time to be had in that 11:19, and... Camille, I think, will be going for a 6 hour, 50 mile and 6 hour world records rather than 100 mile again. But I think she will push on and try and set other marks if those two go to plan. Whereas Zach and Alexander are very much focused on 100 mile. So that would be amazing if we can see that. What other news do you have then to wrap up our pre-interview chat? You've moved Rerun.
Rerun has moved, yeah. We've moved to a barn. We're copying you, yeah. Yeah, it's good actually. Yeah, I'm in a much better space. Yeah. So, and it's quite stressful, isn't it? Moving. They say it's like a stressful. So I'm glad it's all done. Yeah. And it's looking good for Rerun. We're both at the National Running Show, aren't we?
Oh yeah, I forgot about that.
What's your topic? What are you talking on?
I know this is really bad. I'm not quite sure. I think that there's an ultra-specific area, and I know that Camille Heron is there, and Laz,
yeah,
the Barclay RD. I believe I'm on one bit for about half an hour talking about 100 milers. I think possibly... Like how to prepare for the more common pitfalls or something, like from a race director standpoint, maybe. And then I'm on again, I think, later that day or the next day with Laz and someone else, I think. I'm not entirely sure. What are you doing? Are you talking about...
Well, I like three different roles. I'm doing a talk. Is it a talk or are they just asking us questions?
I hope they're asking us questions because I haven't heard otherwise. I've not prepared anything.
But my subject is going long. That's what I've got anyway.
Ooh.
But then we're there with Rerun as well.
Have you got a stand or a little chat?
Yeah, we've got a stand, yeah. So
excellent.
We're there to chat and encourage people not to... consume hideously and also to pick up if anyone brings in a kit to unwanted kit.
Bring your kit down, bring it.
But then also, my kind of day job, my flapjack sort of job with Otopia, they're there as well.
So
I'll have to be punting out some flapjacks at some point as well.
Yeah.
But did they make, so for all the speakers, they've made these Lego people. Have they made one for you?
No comment.
Come on, tell me about it. My one looks nothing like...
That's so why good. I said no comment. I got encouraged to share the Lego... what do you call it? An emoji or something? I don't know. I won't be sharing it. It is... I mean, it could be... It's just a Lego character. I don't think it's me. Some of them are quite good. Like Dave Hellard, who's doing the... comparing, I think, on the Ultra stage, sent me his. It's really good.
Can you send me yours, please? I want to see.
Did you get a Christmas one with a Santa's hat on it as well?
Yeah. But what did you... I want to know what your... You had to, like, name a... They asked you for, like, I don't know, what colour trainers you wore and what colour shorts or... And then they ask you for like a prop or something you'd be holding. What did you say for your prop?
I can't remember. I've just typed in National Running Show to my email to see. I can't remember. I would have asked for a yellow T-shirt, I'd imagine. I can't remember. What did you ask? What was your prop?
I said you just got to put me in a down jacket. I didn't. But I just look like a Lego man. I suppose that's the whole thing. We're supposed to look like Lego men. But I just look like a normal Lego man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, same as me. I can't even find it. I don't know. I'm sure it'll be there on the screen when we go down. Oh, did you have to pick opening music that you come on to?
I told them to pick it for me. Pick me something from the... like old school hardcore rave of the early 1990s.
I sent them the theme music to this podcast.
Bjork or
Bjork. Right, so come to National Running Show. You can see Dan talking about himself and me talking about myself. Centurion Running have a stand. We're sharing a stand. We've cohabited with La Sportiva and Petzl. So come and see us, and then go and see Rerun and find out how you can better look after your clothes and buy less shit. Eat some flapjacks and generally mill around. It's bound to be in creds, totes and creds.
Yeah, so you're there for the whole weekend.
Yeah. No, I'm working, mate. I'm working the La Sportiva Petzl stand, and in return we've got a little bit of the stand dedicated to Centurion.
And were you there last year as well?
I've never been there before.
Okay. So I don't know. What happens in the evening? The extracurricular is there?
What?
Do you work hard, play hard at the National Running Show?
How are we going to get a run in, eh? Where are we going to go running? There must be a track inside or something we can run around during the day.
We can go hiking around the track.
Get a hike on. yeah, I have no idea what to expect. So we'll see how that works out. We have an interview pending. Andy Milroy, who is the stats guru for all of ultra running. So we're just going to get going. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year.
Keep living your best life and all that stuff.
May the joy be with you.
And in you too.
Yeah.
All right, see you soon, mate.
See you later.
Here's Andy Milroy. If we rewind a bit, Andy, if we talk about how you came into the sport and particularly ultra running, are you a runner as a background yourself, or have you always been interested in a refereeing, record keeping capacity?
I came into the sport. I'm no runner. I never have. I think I'm probably biomechanically unsuitable. anyway, I got involved in sport in 1960, the Olympic Games. I saw that and got interested. By 1962, I was keeping records, and I was very interested in the European Games, which was held in 62.
Yep.
And I started getting involved, interested again in the early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, in ultra running, because I saw reference to it in Mel Wharton's book, Encyclopedia of Athletics, and I wanted to know more. And I found increasingly people didn't have any information. And I eventually was advised to get in touch with the Road Runners Club. I got involved with the Road Runners Club, and then I, working with John Jewell, I then started to tackle their stats and work with them on their statistical side. And by 1980, I was RRC statistician. Now, what I discovered when I was doing the ultras, looking at the ultra stuff, there was virtually nothing. In the 1950s, what happened was the IWF stopped all track records beyond 30K.
Okay.
So the RRC took those up, and had by the 1950s, 1951, 52. Following the Brighton, being revived in 1951, they then started looking at the old-time track records, which had been set in the 1880s. All you had was the last person in the 1880s hold a record, and that was it. So I started investigating. And so I eventually was able to trace, and I produced something called Distance Running Progressive Bests, which was published in sort of a small paper thing, in the late 70s.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
And traced it back to the earliest ones, back into sort of maybe 1850s. And then what I did a thing called the Long Distance Record Book, which went back in 1988, which went back as far as I could.
Nobody else had really looked into this before you got excited about it and interested in the sport. This was basically lost to time, and it was you who originally compiled a lot of the stats from, you know, the past 150 odd years. Is that right?
Yeah. Basically, what I found was when I started, it's like going into a cave with a torch, and you're seeing things on the wall that nobody else has seen. What I discovered is you can very rapidly become a world authority, and it's ridiculous how quick that can happen. Because I've basically one of the few people doing it. There were people who were recording the 100-kilometer races in Europe, for example, and Nick Marshall was doing so in America in 1977. But basically, there wasn't that kind of background information and getting it all together. So what happened was, in the 70s, early 80s, began to build up a network of people of passing information backwards and forwards. And in fact, by 1984 or 83, this had been quite well developed. And, I was going to races and officiating at races and so on. And gradually that network was built up. And it was on those kind of networks that the IAU was built. I was a co-founder of the IAU.
So if we look at the early 1980s, you say that by 83, 84, you had a pretty comprehensive record. If you had to make a guess, of all the previous performances that could be considered record eligible or record breaking, what percentage of them do you think by that point that you'd swept up and accounted for?
Now, you've got to realise that already I was RSC statistician, and the RSC have been keeping records for the 1950s.
Okay.
So I got involved with that whole process. So he had network across the world, and all this information came into the newsletter.
How was this record keeping being? Was it just like manual notes? Are we talking, because this is obviously before computers. Are we talking about, somebody at home has just got literally a log book of records? Is that how it worked?
Okay, no. The situation is that if a record was set, you had a particular recording sheet, and that every lap had to be recorded. Mm-hmm. That was set, the record of those laps was sent into the RSC.
Right.
It was checked, and then what would happen is that information would be recorded, would be sort of either checked. So, in other words, the whole thing was the RSC was disseminating best practice. It had its own rules, and that was disseminated. And what happened was the RSC newsletter was produced three times a year, and you had the record lists in there. You not only had that, you had all time lists listed in there.
Right. And they went, okay. So anybody in the RRC is receiving this newsletter, and the records are therefore public information for the first time, really.
Yeah, and also the thing to bear in mind is Jim Shapiro, who wrote the book Ultramarathon, he said to me that the RRC newsletter was the best communication on ultra running or distance running in the world.
And by this point, this is through the 1970s, we've got the likes of Don Ritchie coming through and setting world records.
Don Ritchie only really went 100 miles, but you actually got people like Boussiquet coming through. Mm-hmm. And Boussiquet is a very major French runner who actually came over and ran it, set a new record at Blackburn, which was also an RSC event.
This is for 100K or 100 miles?
164 was 24 hours.
24 hours, right, okay. Hours. But the sport at this point in the UK, could you just briefly describe the state of the sport in the UK in 1980? What did it look like?
The mid-1980s was quite truncated. You got a situation whereby London and Brighton, the Woodward South End, the SLH 30, which had been going since the during war years, and you had got the two oceans, so two bridges up in Scotland. So there were maybe four or five or six ultra races. There have been earlier ones in the 1950s. There were races like Exeter to Plymouth and Blackpool to Manchester. There had been point-to-point races, but those eventually have become just too difficult for the police and whatever to handle, and they died out after four or five editions. So, you were down to maybe four or five or six actual races taking place. Alongside this, of course, you've got the Long Distance Running Walkers Association putting on challenge events over miles and so on. Mm-hmm. So there were that sort of thing going on. But in fact, apart from that, it was quite limited. The people who actually were running those ultra races, at that point, they weren't called ultra races. They effectively were long marathons.
Okay.
Because the word ultra marathon was developed and first used on ultra distance. It was first used by Ted Corbett, in America. But in fact, Don Ritchie first when John Ritchie went over in, I think, 79 to Flushing Meadow and ran 11:51 for 100 miles, he actually heard the expression for the first time. So you, basically, what you had was marathon runners running some longer marathons.
Okay, so we could say the term ultra running or ultra marathon was first coined in the late 1970s by Ted Corbett, because I had no idea of that. Okay, wow.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So okay. In other words, the whole thing is, you know, what you're doing, what I've been doing, is documenting, you know, when things happened, because that is really interesting. So what emerged was there were, because there was not the opportunity to run ultra distance, so effectively people would run marathons mainly, which meant they retained their foot, their leg speed. And so you get the situation where the London Brighton and other races were much faster because you did not have people coming into the race with ultra leg speed. And the comments made by people who will be around then and around now is that, you know, the standards have declined. The reason is partly, I think, is because, first of all, there's less people running them in terms of there's more fun runners. And secondly, because, you know, there is a greater range, so people get used to running at a particular pace, which is much slower.
Mm-hmm. So we're in the mid-1980s now. You've established yourself as kind of the primary protagonist in compiling records and being responsible for record keeping. You mentioned you were co-founder of the IAU. The IAU, for listeners, is the International Association of Ultra Runners, who are responsible these days for organising the trail, 50K, 100K and 24-hour European and World Championships, and indeed Continental Championships, as well as record keeping and ratification of courses, that kind of thing, specific mostly to road and track racing, but also to multi-terrain. Andy, what led to the creation of the IAU? How did you get involved and who did you set that up with?
Yanis Kouros ran the Spartathlon, and then Kouros went and destroyed the field in that Spartathlon.
And this is 1985, is it, that Kouros first ran Sparta, off the top of my head?
84, I think.
84, okay, yep.
Now, the situation is, because Spartathlon, a lot of it is actually in darkness, there were concerns that, about, you know, taking lifts and whatever.
Yeah.
So they organised a Daniel race, and he competed against the top runners in Iran and Spartathlon, and again, he did very, very well. In 84, you get the six-day race in New York. And the six-day race in New York, Yanis Kouros was invited. And he came out and he ran 160 miles in the first day. Okay, Bruce Slade was sending back the results to me. And we were talking to him. He said, nah, he won't last. Then he went through and he broke the 48-hour record in the next day. And then he was going on, and we expected him to crash, and he didn't. But by the fourth day, when he came out, he tried to start running, and he couldn't. He stuck. But again, he got going again, and eventually, as I said, he broke the he broke George Littlewood's record, which had existed for 6 years.
So you, at this point, Andy, you're watching. Yeah. And this guy has shown up. He's won Spartathlon twice in times that seem to be beyond comprehension. He's then run 160 miles on the first day, then gone on and broken the 48 and 6 hour, 6 day world records all at the same time. What, you know, at this point, what are you thinking? Is this, are you thinking this is the, you know, the greatest of, potentially the greatest of all time, that this guy's got incredible talent, or are there still doubts about performances at this stage?
I didn't. I actually wrote an article, How Good is Yanis Kouros?
Right.
Which is in the RT newsletter. So it was my thought at the time. I think he at this point, he was obviously had great potential. The thing is, he wasn't limited. coming new to the sport, he wasn't really aware of limitations. Okay? The situation is, he hadn't come up through it. He didn't know you're not supposed to do that.
Right.
So he did things. And this, so in other words, he was a 224 marathon runner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So he had good quality credentials. And he was quite fast. So in other words, he knew what he could run at. But what was interesting, and what became interesting later on, is his power to disassociate himself. In other words, what happened was he typically would use music and poetry and whatever to take his constant focus on that and not on his body. And in fact, what he would do is actually, when he was running a 24-hour, for example, he would just focus on the music and everything else, and then he would actually come back in after about 6 hours, see how his body was going, then go back into his brain again. But the thing is, with Kouros, the thing you need to be aware of is, and with Wally Haywood, and with Don Ritchie, is they were meticulous. They are very, very organised. If you, when you see the likes of William Sichel, for example, when you see them do events, they plan everything. Mm-hmm. Food, drink, terrain. For example, when he was looking at Bale, and what he was doing is before the race, he walked around the course and he was looking where the camber was and where the tight areas were and how much room he'd have to go around there. So he sussed out the course the whole time, looking at the smoothness of the course and so on. And then in terms of feeding, which is the most important thing, he actually would have the kind of food that he needed to have on a very regular basis. You're talking about every single lap he would take, drinks he would have. And, for example, Haywood, when he ran, he would have a different hand signal to show to his handler what drink he required coming up to. So he would signal with his hand and show what drink he wanted, maybe 30, 40 metres down, back, and the handler would give him exactly what he needed. For instance, Don Ritchie, when he was running the Flushing 100 miler, he complained bitterly to Marshall, who was giving him the sponges, that he needed the sponge in his left hand, not his right hand. In other words, these people are really, really extremely well organised, and their training is very, they have analysed everything in incredible detail and know exactly what they want.
Now, if we fast forward over the next 10 years or so, you've got Kouros going on to, and this isn't all about Yannis Kouros, I should add, but this is a guy who holds every record, I believe, Andy, or at least has until recently held every record from 24, 48, 6 day, 1,000 mile, 10 day. And they're still looking at it now. Of the 24-hour all-time formuses, how many are Yannis's? Are they 14 of the top 20? Is that
24.
Right?
Actually, I was looking at this for Ian Champion yesterday. He only has got the top four.
He's got the top four 24-hour performances of all time.
Yeah. Then it's Hara of Japan, mm-hmm. and then two or three more. Then you've got Dennis
Zalabin.
Zalabin, yeah, okay, who's next? And in fact, Zalabin has run faster over 200K than Yannis has.
Okay. But during the early 90s, Kouros was in a class of his own. In fact, his 24-hour world record is 303K. Is how far beyond the next closest runner? About 15K further than anybody else has ever run, is that correct?
More like 18K.
And how? How is that possible, Andy? You've said he was his planning was meticulous. He had the leg speed anyway and the raw fitness of being a 224 marathoner. Mentally, he was able to take himself out of body experience almost.
Okay.
Was there anything else that he did that allowed him to create this huge gap?
First of all, you've got to realise that Yannis Kouros is a self-made runner. He actually developed from the Yannis Kouros in 84... And the one who ran in the 90s was quite different.
Okay.
I saw him in 1990 when he was running in Duluth. And his action was very much more compact, limited back lift on his legs, and he was used of his arms very strongly. He was still quite strongly built. Now, the thing is, what he had done is he'd done weight. If you read in the book, Ultra Training, you'll see I actually did an analysis of what he had actually done to improve on that capability. Now, what is interesting with that is that he actually deliberately set out weight training to develop his core strength, because core is is essential for 24 hours and 100 miles and beyond. You've got to keep your core. What if your core collapses? You can become inefficient.
Yep.
And you do run efficiently. So he kept his core. What he also did was he actually developed his muscular strength. He looks more like a wrestler.
Yep.
And the reason why is because he used his arms to drive his body forward. When he did his races in 1984, he was going off fast. What is fascinating is you look at his lap sheets. I have checked all his lap sheets. And what is interesting is he goes from fast starting, you know, sub 12 hours, 100 miler.
Mm-hmm.
He will go to slightly over 7 hours for the 100K. He will then go to over 15 and a half, 16 hours for 200K. You know, he is taking a much more even paced approach. Whereas in fact, before he was blitzing it.
Yeah.
And for example, when he said we was first for our mark at Montauban in 85, he didn't run for the last 2 hours or something. Okay.
Wow.
So he then.
Wow.
I know. So in other words, he gradually became. For example, when he did his first 48-hour record, he walked for 400K basically.
That's
so he gradually became more effective and more efficient. He was a great student of the sport, and also in terms of food. For example, when he was running around, he would get somebody to give a piece of Greek pastry, mm-hmm. or something, or a piece of bar, or a segment of chocolate, mm-hmm. or something else. Each lap, he's something to eat the whole time.
The calorie intake of his Perth to Sydney run, and it is quite astounding the amount of food he was able to take on and keep down consistently is way in advance of anything I've seen since. I've never seen anybody in the countless races I've organized or witnessed or run myself eat anywhere near the quantity which he was able to consume. Do you think that was practice in training, or was he blessed with the ability just to get past these GI issues that so many suffer today?
I think to a certain extent, if you've got any sense, you're practicing training.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's the first thing. Secondly, there's a race, the Auckland to Wellington race, which was held pre-Coros. And they actually did, I've actually got a situation whereby they actually measured the amount of calorific intake. Those with a high calorific intake finished. Those without it didn't. So it's not just him. If you don't have that kind of energy basis, you're going to not make it.
Mm.
So you've got to be able to. But the thing is, that sort of calorific intake, you've got to practice and everything else. You right to realize when Coros was running his half 48-hour race, he had a whole structure he would take. For example, before a 100-mile race, before a 24-hour race, he would run a 100K race. Okay? So he was as training. And before he ran the 48-hour races, he would run in Australia, he would run a 24-hour race. And in those races, he was using developing his body, getting his body used to that kind of input. Now, I suspect the trouble that people have with eating is they are eating too much at one point. In other words, they wait until they're hungry. Whereas, relative to Coros, and others, they actually were taking a little bit, little tiny small amount from the very start, constantly, little bit, little bit, little bit, all the time, the whole time, and drinking as well. And they have worked out exactly what they need. Now, Bernd Heinrich, when he was running his 100 mile or whatever, he would use one race, he used cranberry juice. Subsequently, his body refused to accept that. So, in other words, you do need variety when you're in terms of taking food. Some savoury, some sweet, because otherwise, because your body does not cope with or gets objects to, it's just more, your palate becomes desensitised. Okay. In other words, the prolonged distance affects your body, how it is. This is why I've suggested that scientists need to study ultra runners in such events, probably on a track, from the point of view, their bodies are operating under that kind of stress, which will reveal new and different things that are not obvious if you're doing an all-body rest.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and I think at the moment that's what we're lacking, you know, the science, the data. I think we're in many ways we sort of stagnated between Kouros and today. And we'll come to modern day performances of the last several years, perhaps in a moment. But just in terms of our journey, if we go back to our timeline, we're into the mid 1990s. Towards the end of the 90s, the early 2000s in the UK, the sport kind of died off in that performances declined. There were less races. You know, some classics began, for example, the Grand Union Canal Race, but they were extremely limited in number and the fields were small. What was the global and UK kind of picture like between 95 and 2005?
I think you've got to go back a bit and realise the difference that the huge influx of East Africans made. What had happened is that no longer could ordinary European athletes make a living, the elite ones, make a living from the sport because of the degree of qualification.
From marathon running?
In the shorter events.
Right.
So consequently, more importantly, they weren't people who were role models. You know, they were not Europeans winning the races. So you didn't have the role models for the next generation.
Right.
Partly, what you've had is in Western countries, particularly, you actually have had the number of distance runners competing, elite ones, diminished. You've actually had with the things like the London Marathon, the Great North Run. You've had a lot of people who are not runners or are people who are limited things, who are joggers and whatever, have come into the sport, and they have met at numbers. But because of that, the actual standards have dropped. Okay?
Absolutely.
You do not have as many club runners competing. Mm-hmm. Now, this is true not just in this country, it's true throughout most of Western Europe, and it's also true in the United States. Now, in the United States, because you've got trail runners competing and they've got no outside competition, they have been successful, they've had role models, and that means that they can then bring that expertise into the world events. So, in other words, that is that degree of difference. When you go back to looking at the European, as I said, their numbers have dropped. Now, ultra runners is dependent on coming from the base level of distance running. The ultra runners have moved up, generally speaking, from the marathon, from the 10K, and they are the ones who are coming in. If you actually diminish the base from which you're coming from, then it's going to be much lower. Mm. Now, what has happened is that with the men, it has been particularly noticeable that there's been stagnation at 100K, for example, up and over the last 10, 15 years, and it hasn't made much progress. Now, what has happened is the women's sport has increased. The reason partly is that the number of East African women coming to the sport is much, much less. There is still the situation whereby women do not have the freedom to actually make choices because of the family, that they may not be able to go into and compete as widely as they can. Now, so what's happening is that European women have not had the same level of competition. So, in other words, you've still got a base and it's still coming through. And, of course, women tend to operate competitively more effectively at ultras than men. They are not as affected by testosterone, anything else. They don't go off too fast. And that is whereas men tend to. They get the adrenaline and they just go off far too fast.
In the early 90s, so the East African men are starting to come in through and really dominate the marathon scene, the track and cross-country scene as well. And then you're getting less competitive European and American runners because the East Africans are kind of crowding them out. So then they start looking towards ultras, or we're just not seeing runners coming through into the longer distances of the same calibre as we were?
Basically, the role models have gone. Less people coming into the sport and being inspired to actually come through.
Right. The participation numbers go down, and some races then died away as a result of that.
What is interesting, because there were a limited number of races back in the 70s and early 80s, the top runners were racing each other regularly.
Yeah.
Now, what's happening is you've got so much more choice, the top runners don't have to. The top runners are much more diffuse.
Yep.
So anyway, you're not getting head-to-head competition in the same way late in the 90s and whatever that you had earlier.
I think that's very true of today too, Andy. You know, with respect to a lot of the top trail events, the depth of competition isn't there. And it's a frustration to me as an organiser that there are so many events because we're diluting the racing conditions, you know. That's why I'm kind of excited about our Track 100 in April, because for the first time we've got a really, you know, competitive group of runners who are going to be able to push each other to the limit. And that should make for better racing, you know, all round. There will be the inevitable explosions, I'm sure, and then those that fade away and drop out. But I think that will lead to two, three, four runners, you know, persevering and being in with a chance of running something truly special.
That's the end of the first part of our interview with Andy Milroy. Sorry it's somewhat of an abrupt end. It seemed a logical place to leave it at the sort of around the hour mark. And we will focus next time with Andy on some of the historical women's performances, as well as looking at modern day running and the last 4 or 5 years since ultra running's gone through somewhat of a boom period, both in the UK, the US and across the world. And look at the trends that are happening and where Andy sees records and performances going to in the not too distant future. Until the next time, thanks for listening.